Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sidorek. If you've been to a holiday party, turned on the radio, or walked into pretty much any department store this time of year, you've probably heard this.
The neighbors might
think. But baby, it's bad out there.
Say, what's in this drink?
No cabs to be had out there.
I wish I knew how.
Your eyes are like stars right now.
To break this spell.
I'll take your hat. Your hair looks swell.
I ought to say no, no, no,
mind
sir.
If I move in closer?
At least I'm gonna say that I try.
What's the sense of hurting my pride?
I really can't
Oh, baby,
stay.
Don't hold out, baby.
Oh, but it's cold outside.
But in the era of Me Too, does Baby It's Cold Outside still have a place among the Christmas classics? Joining me now to unpack this song and how to deal with it is Maura Johnston. She's a writer, editor, adjunct professor at Boston College, and a contributor to the Boston Globe and the online magazine Pitchfork. Maura, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks.
And also here with us is Joe Bennett, a musicologist and vice president for academic affairs at Berklee College of Music here in Boston. Hi, Joe.
Hi, good to be here.
And listeners, we want to hear from you on this as well. Should Baby It's Cold Outside be taken out of the Christmas song rotation? Where does the song and its more controversial lyrics fall into the wider conversation about consent spurred by the Me Too movement? And do we lose anything if we decide to put it on the shelf? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So I'll start just by opening this up to you guys. What's your reaction to the song and to the kind of growing controversy? It's becoming an annual tradition that we talk about the song and whether or not it has a place. What do you think?
Well, we live in sort of very sensitive times with this issue, and it's a front and center issue for our society at large. But when Maura and I were discussing this song earlier, one thing we really agreed on was that it's a song of its time.
Yes,
it was written
very
in
much
19,
of its time.
Yeah, it was written in 1944, and it's about a lot of the social mores of that period.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the woman's side of the story, so to speak, you can see a lot of her excuses for not wanting to stay are rooted in her what the community might think.
Right.
What her sister, her brother, the neighbors, et cetera. And, you know, I think what happens with 70 years of time is that a lot of subtleties and context get lost when you talk about any cultural artifact. So while I think, you know, the song definitely can come off as very almost predatory, and as noted by the fact that, you know, in the original writing, the two characters were called Wolf and Mouse.
Yeah, absolutely.
I also think that the tendency to the bad faith reading is a little overstated. That said, there are so many Christmas songs. So many, right? And this is a song that I think would not have made the cut for any of Frank Lesser's, like, musicals. So why not just, you know, put it aside for a bit and maybe give something else a little bit of a spotlight.
Well, it's you say that, but it has definitely generated some strong reactions this year, especially. You had radio stations in Cleveland, San Francisco, and Denver say we're pulling it completely. And then you had a radio station in Elizabethtown, Kentucky, Wacky Radio, W-A-K-Y, say they went the other way and said we're playing the song, five different versions of it, for 2 hours straight. Got to imagine that's kind of like torture in some places. Of the world,
and it seems kind of antithetical to the Christmas spirit, right? Like the whole thing about the Christmas spirit is like peace on earth, goodwill to fellow people. And it's like, we're going to make you feel super uncomfortable for 2 hours straight. And why would you do that? That just seems like such a jerky move. They get coal for them.
And there are so many references in that lyric where it's clear that they're coming from that 1940s perspective. You know, what will my maiden aunt think?
Right, right.
And in fact, to my subjective ears, one of the most shocking things in it is all the references to cigarettes and smoking. You could not release a song now that actually has in there.
So to push back on that a little bit.
Yeah, let's do it.
Because there are some troubling lines. Everybody cites the "so what's in this drink?" But I actually thought the line, I played that specific selection at the top because when she says, "I ought to say no, 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 sir," and he responds with, "mind if I move in closer," that kind of theme of pursuing her, is it can feel pretty aggressive. And Joe, when we were talking before, you sent me a link to the 1949 movie where this song kind of first hit the main stage.
Right.
And the first iteration, the guy is pretty physically aggressive with her, kind of pushing her back on the couch, taking her coat off, taking her hat off, there are some troubling themes in this song.
Yes, I think through a 2018 lens, the idea of manipulating anyone physically to do what you want is not of our time and not something that's very comfortable with our society now. Of course, being an MGM classic Technicolor movie, it's all highly choreographed and they have some play with the hat and they're on and off the couch in rhythm and so on. But I think you're right. It's a fair point. It's troubling. And that line, what's in this drink, is... obviously one can read it very, very negatively. The way it seems to me to be acted in the movie is that the female character, the mouse character, is like, oh my goodness, I don't know my own reason what's in this drink. Have right. I drunk too much and should I just get out of here?
Yeah.
But what I take from the 1949 version, that movie Neptune's Daughter, the way the two characters interact, and a lot of the cover versions since, is that both characters are sort of enjoying the playful interaction. Now, I don't want to be an apologist for the wolf character, but more I'm making an argument for art in context, because it makes a stronger social point than it does a relationships and dating interaction point, to me anyway.
So I want to get some callers in here as well. Deborah from Beverly, you're on the line joining us. Deborah, what's on your mind?
Yes, there are some certain radio stations that I don't listen to because I don't like the lyrics in some of the songs, and I don't want anyone else censoring what I listen to. If you find the song offensive, switch stations.
It's a simple solution. The idea of censorship, is this kind of a slippery slope thing if we start to say, okay, art? I mean, we're kind of constantly doing that, right? We're looking at art from the past and deciding, okay, this is still relevant, this not so much. Do you think this borders on censorship, pulling the song from the rotation?
No, because there are just too many. I mean, I think, well, first of all, it's private companies are making these decisions. It's not like the government is blaring, you know, Christmas carols 24/7, although who knows if that's going to be the case eventually. But I think that, you know, companies have a right to make their decisions. I don't think it's censorship. I think if you claim playlist decisions are censorship, then any artist that gets left off a radio playlist can say I'm being censored or I'm being marginalized, which is ridiculous. And I also just think that, you know, not playing one particular song because it may be out of time. I mean, it happens all the time. It happens with Sonics. It happens with other words that may have been acceptable 20 years ago or even 10 years ago that aren't now. But the censorship argument is just does not hold water with me at all.
And the great thing about living in a streaming world is you can't censor stuff. It's just not possible because no one channel, certainly no one government, owns all the means of distribution to our art forms. And that's one of the reasons I love the study of popular music and just being around popular music, because it's people like what they like. The market decides. People listen to the music that makes them feel the way they want to feel. And I think anyone who wanted to censor any song is going to have their work cut out.
it'll serve as a marketing point, even, you know. Band in the USA was a huge hit for Two Live Crew. I bought
it
single
just increases
back
demand
in the day.
So I want to go back to the phones here. Lucas in Stoneham, you're on the line. Lucas, what's on your mind today? What do you think about the song?
I think the song is fine. I think everybody's missing the point. The point of the song, the problem in the song is not that she is trying to say no and he's making strong advances of being aggressive. The problem is that she wants to say yes, and in her time and to this day, women can't have a sexual agency to say yes. She's looking for excuses. She's trying to find something in her drink to explain the fact that she really wants to do this. She's making excuses. She doesn't know how she's going to present herself to her aunt. Or whomever. So that's my point.
And Lucas, you're kind of echoing what our guests have said, but I want to contrast that with Mark Hirsch. He's a music correspondent for the Boston Globe. I spoke with him about this yesterday. He basically said that he used to defend this song, but that a specific conversation he had over the last year has kind of changed his mind on that.
Last year, a friend who has a teenage daughter said, I understand all that, but when I'm trying to teach my daughter how consent works and to be firm with what she's saying and teach my son to understand that no means no, it is not an invitation for further negotiation, how do I defend this song, which basically stomps all over that?
So how do you reconcile those two? You know, on the one hand, you have the kind of social context. On the other, in the current moment where we're so focused and aware of consent and trying to have a healthy dialogue about it, does this song still have a place in 2018?
I think that it doesn't, except as a maybe as a sort of example of how romance has traditionally been portrayed in popular culture as something where the man pursues and the woman is pursued, the sort of dragging the woman by the hair ideal, where the gender roles are very sort of fixed and also the woman has to be pliant to the man's desires. But I also think that Baby It's Cold Outside is hardly the only, you know, artifact that deserves this sort of viewing. I mean, any rom-com from even 5 years ago probably has the same element.
Yeah.
So I think that this conversation, the overall Me Too conversation and the talk that we're having about consent, we're at a starting point. But there are going to be a lot of things that are going to be viewed through the lens of what it means for a woman to want to be romantically pursued and what the whole idea of romantic pursuit even means.
Yeah. So we're talking a lot about how it lands today and kind of the current moment. I do want to give some historical context. And so I spoke yesterday with Judith Smith. She's a professor of American Studies at UMass Boston. And she talked about how the war era was really this time of real social change.
It's written at a time of transition. The war context has really shifted everything. We can sort of think of the war era as having a kind of frantic heterosexuality that's expressed in higher marriage and divorce rates. That sort of remains all through the 40s. People are moving from small town and inward-looking parochial ethnic communities. They're moving all over the country with war industry, and they're moving into the military and being exposed to people from all different times and places. So there's just incredible social shifts during the war period. And I think of that, this song in particular, as expressing a kind of playful, cosmopolitan sexual modernism. There's a new focus on sexual candor and kind of using the language of sex, working that into songs in a playful way. That's certainly something that was part of Cole Porter songs from the 20s and the 30s, and it continues to be presence in the 1940s. You know, if you think about the wartime, women were being encouraged to go dance with soldiers at canteens and recreational spaces for people in the military. There's just a lot of movement and a lot of new opportunities to meet people outside your network and to shift out of a kind of protective surveillance of family and ethnic community about what's right and what's wrong and sort of opening up a wider sphere of possibilities. And I think it's also a time that expressions of women's sexual desire enter into public in a way sort of parallel to men. And I think the song, as written, is playing with that.
So it's hard to kind of put ourselves in that moment 70 plus years ago, but I think it is an element of where it comes from.
Certainly from the amount that is in the lyric, that idea, I love that phrase, protective surveillance.
Right.
Yeah.
The female characters, the mouse character is really bothered by this.
Right.
And I think as times have changed, what's really interested me about researching this song is that people have flipped the genders many times. You know,
it's funny you should mention that because I have a caller who wants to discuss that.
Oh,
Lisa
great.
From Brookline, you're on the air. Lisa, what's on your mind?
Hi. I don't think the lyric is open to interpretation. The lyric at the heart of it is basically a man not taking no for an answer from a woman. I think what is open to interpretation is through the era, through the ages, the eras are different with how that has been accepted or interpreted. A woman saying no used to be considered years ago as flirtation and even encouragement. And now today in the Me Too movement, we know that isn't true.
So let me ask you, Lisa, when we flip the genders, does that matter?
I think anyone who is trying to say no and not being heard, it can very much matter, and it does. I mean, I again... the tradition and the time that this was written, the traditional way of looking at it was a woman could be even encouraging or flirting with a man if she was saying no because men decided that was the way it should be. And a lot of women got taken advantage of a lot due to that mindset.
Yeah.
So, again, it's a man simply not taking no for an answer over and over and over again in the lyric.
So I think it's a complicated issue, historical context, the current social moment. I don't know that we'll come to a nice, easy answer. So let's move more. Like you said, there's lots of other Christmas songs out
there. There's so many other Christmas songs.
I asked you guys each to pick a favorite. Mara, I want to start with you. You originally gave a different selection, but then the second selection you gave me, it gave me an excuse to play some Jim Henson work. So
amazing.
Let's hear a little bit of that, and you can tell me why you love it.
Soul food, they still got a soul. And it don't mean that you got no rhythm if you don't like rock and roll. But if you taste like mine, you like cider, not wine.
Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas. What is
best.
It?
It's a special that was on HBO many decades ago. It is a retelling, basically, of The Gift of the Magi with an otter. Some poor otters who are in a band trying to make it big in a battle of the bands against the Riverbottom Nightmare Band, which was my first exposure.
I almost
exposure.
Pulled that one, but I was like,
yeah.
I was gonna know what this
that was my first exposure to like acid rock as a child. Very, very influential. And it's just really charming. It's told with the puppets of the Jim Henson Company. The songs are all written by Paul Williams, who is an amazing songwriter. And
it really taps into that nostalgia.
Yeah.
Which, Joe, you and I talked about, is that's kind of one of the big appeals for Christmas songs. I want to play your selection,
right.
And then we can kind of talk about that as a general selection. So this is one of your favorite Christmas ditties. Jamie didn't like that, I think. That's all right. So that is Fairy Tale of New York. Tell me why that one jumps out to you.
So, it's the Pogues featuring Kirsty MacColl. And I do have a colleague who says that all the best pop music came out in the year you were 17. And this did come out in the year
there
I was 17. So that's perhaps my cultural bias there. But I love that it's a dark story. It's a story of an arguing couple, two drunks, Irish drunks,
in
who
New York
literally
City.
Wind up in New York City. It opens, "It was Christmas Eve, babe, in the drunk tank." And the chorus goes, "The boys in the NYPD choir were singing Galway Bay." And it's just this backwards and forwards of an
beautiful,
argument.
Beautiful.
But they're having a terrible time, this couple.
So we're going to go out to my favorite. I picked Mariah Carey because I think this should be the one people remember her for. But anyway, that's Maura Johnson, writer, editor, adjunct professor at Boston College. Maura, thanks so much for coming
in. Thank you.
And Joe Bennett, musicologist and vice president for academic affairs at Berklee College here in Boston. Joe,
thanks for being here.
Good
to see you.
That's our show for today. I'm Chris Sidorek. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.